ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making One Nation.
This is the unlikely story of One Nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
You pick up your phone to check one message. The next thing you know, you've spent half an hour watching a lady tradie in Perth build a backyard water slide for her dog. True story. Social media is remarkably, intentionally, really good at turning a spare minute into an entire lunch break. So if these platforms are designed to capture our attention, what can we do to make them less addictive? Also, why don't we have widespread online voting yet? And the latest AI training scandal involving nearly every Aussie artist you can imagine. This is Download This Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ray Johnston. Now, joining me to unpack some of the biggest stories in tech right now and why they matter for all of us, we've got Professor Vanessa Teague, who is CEO of Thinking Cybersecurity and an adjunct professor at UNSW. Welcome to Download This Show, Vanessa.
Hello, Ray.
And we've got Professor Michael Cowling, Professor of Educational Technology at RMIT, otherwise known around here as Professor Tech. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks, Ray. Great to be here.
I think it's safe to say that we are lacking trust in our politicians at the moment. One thing that we do have a lot of trust in, though, is our electoral processes. Online voting sounds like a natural next step for a digital society. So is this something that we might have in place by the next time we have to hit the polling booths? Vanessa, where does Australia stand with online voting? Are we close to having it everywhere or nowhere near it at all?
Well, we have experimented with it, remember? I mean, you're in New South Wales.
Yes.
New South Wales for a long time had the largest internet voting project in the world, which crashed spectacularly during the 2021 local government elections and disenfranchised thousands of people. So where we are in terms of being close to having it is we've had it and it didn't work all that well. And I would like to think we've had a little bit of an educational salutary experience. However, the Victorian Electoral Commission has recently come out and said that they'd like to run internet voting for local council elections here. So I'm not sure where we're at.
Okay, so interesting times to be tapping into this topic. Michael, when we hear online voting, what do most people imagine and how is that maybe a little bit different to the reality?
I think, look, I don't know about most people, but definitely for me, I think we imagine, you know, the slippers and the cup of coffee sitting at the computer at home, clicking a button and deciding which person's going to be the next prime minister. But I think in reality, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And sometimes when people talk about internet voting or online voting or using technology, they just mean using technology in the booth and not necessarily what we're doing at home. And regardless, especially if we're thinking about what we're doing at home, it's just really hard, as Vanessa just said, in terms of security, in terms of availability, it's a difficult problem to solve.
Yeah. Vanessa, can you give me an idea of what can go wrong with online voting? What has specifically happened previously? What are we afraid of?
Well, how long have you got? But I actually think it's really important to understand that the obvious crash is not the worst thing that can happen, not even close. The worst thing that can happen with an unverifiable electoral system is that everything seems fine and everybody goes home happy and everybody announces a shiny-looking election result, but actually we lose the evidence trail that that election result is correct. So the real problem with online voting isn't that it might crash or that it might be unreliable, although that's a problem too. The real problem with online voting is that we might expose our democracy to undetectable fraud.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, somebody could fiddle the electronic results and maybe nobody else notices.
Oh, and is this something that there is a precedent of?
Well, we don't know, kind of by definition, right? But it's very, very hard to design electronic systems with the kind of evidence trail that we've built around our paper-based systems. Now, it's important to realize that the paper-based system doesn't magically provide an evidence trail either. We've designed our paper-based electoral processes to be open to scrutineering, to protect privacy when people fill out their piece of paper in the ballot box. We actually have a whole lot of really important laws about how scrutineers have to have access to all of the important parts of the process. It's really hard to replicate that kind of public observability in an electronic setting.
I think everyone at some point when they've been voting has thought about the fact that we use a pencil and that it could be rubbed out and our result marked a little bit differently. Michael, why is it easier to trust a paper ballot than a digital one?
I think Vanessa's right. I think ultimately it comes down to the controls that we've built over the years and the fact that when something becomes digital, it just becomes a little bit easier to change. And I think the case study, the classic case study here, of course, is in the States in 2020, where the president at the time made the claim that electronic voting machines had meant that some bad actors had modified the results. And he's able to make that claim because of the idea that they're digital. And so it is easier to change. Whereas when we're marking a piece of paper and we've got real people counting things up with scrutineers looking over their shoulder, we just feel a little bit more comfortable that this is something that is true. But Vanessa's right. Doesn't it mean that it's foolproof and ballot papers do get lost, real ballot papers do get lost and they do get miscounted. It's just that technology makes that process of cheating a little bit easier.
There would be some people that would argue that we've worked out how to do many things online quite securely these days. You know, online banking is one of the things that people would point to as an example. Why can't we secure online voting in the same way and make it as trusted as those other processes?
All of these systems do have security problems and they are subject to fraud. The issue is that the electronic voting process has much higher security requirements than the electronic banking process. For example, you expect your vote to be private, even from the Electoral Commission. And there are all kinds of important reasons for that, because we don't want coercion associated with people's voting choices, even coercion that comes from the administrators themselves. But you don't expect your banking transactions to be private from your bank. That doesn't even make any sense. And so the banks are able to run all kinds of intelligent data analysis to check for fraud. How often have you got a notification that says, there's a suspicious transaction on your credit card, was this you or do we need to cancel your bank? Right?
Yeah, quite a lot.
But you can't get a message from the Electoral Commission that says, you know, you're an overeducated resident of the Inner North. We've got a One Nation vote for you. Is that what you meant? Right? We can't do that because your vote is supposed to be private. So there are all kinds of security mechanisms in place for banking that make sense, but are just not applicable, not possible for voting. Furthermore, with the bank, you need to know that your transactions are properly dealt with, but you don't really care, well, you don't care deeply about other people's banking transactions. But for voting, I care about whether my vote is properly counted, but more importantly, I care about the collective, you know, whether the whole society has properly conducted the election and properly counted the votes. So that's a much higher level of evidence than you get by looking at your own bank transaction.
And can I just add to that? The extension of that argument, of course, is that the consequences are much greater for voting and what happens in voting in any country, but in Australia in particular. When you're voting, you are voting in your Member of Parliament, you're voting in the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister has a lot of power. So I don't want to belittle people's banking transactions, but the reality is that the Prime Minister gets to spend a lot more money and really drive the country. And so if we get the vote wrong, if somebody hacks it, that can have serious consequences for the country.
I'm thinking about other ways that we communicate while shielding our identity online. So encrypted messages, for instance, where, you know, I send a message, it gets scrambled, and only the person with the key can receive it and read it. is there a way for encryption to play a role in online voting, or does that completely get negated by the fact that you need to be able to link it to the fact that you have voted as a citizen? Am I making sense here?
Yes, so that's a very good question. I spend a lot of time researching exactly those kinds of fancy cryptographic protocols for voting. And end-to-end encryption, of course, is one of the kind of the minimal privacy standard that you want for online elections. At an absolute minimum, you don't want the server or whoever controls the server to immediately see how you're voting. So absolutely, that's necessary. The New South Wales iVote system, for what it's worth, did have end-to-end encryption of the individual votes. So even somebody who broke into the server couldn't immediately see how you voted. However, that doesn't completely solve the problem. It doesn't solve the manipulation problem, or the problem that somebody could just substitute a different encrypted vote for your vote. And it only partially solves the privacy problem, because somebody still has to decrypt it eventually in order to count it. And then the question is, well, how well is it disassociated from your identity before it gets decrypted? And there are some fancy cryptographic protocols for doing that disassociation. But there are also some limitations to those protocols and some people who still need to be trusted.
All right. Maybe some tech for the future then, something to still work on. You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National with me, Ray Johnston. And this week we've learned even more. Aussie books, films, songs have reportedly been used to train AI models. At the same time, Cate Blanchett is backing a new human consent registry, which is designed to help people take back some control of their likeness and creative work. Professor Michael Cowling, what exactly has been uncovered about Aussie creative works being used for AI training this week?
I think it is essentially a bunch of Australians identifying that their AI resources have been used to train these models without permission. And we're just getting more and more Australian groups like Kylie Minogue and ACDC and various other places noting that this is actually happening. And to answer your question, 100% is happening. These AI companies, their job is to scrape all of the data that is available into their models so that they can give you better quality results, and that includes Kylie Minogue's Locomotion or ACDC's most famous song as well, because then it's able to generate better output for you.
Professor Vanessa Teague, how do AI companies get their hands on these massive collections? You know, the books and music and films, how are they getting it in the first place?
I mean, the same way that people do, by crawling the web or buying collections of it.
Or stealing it?
Well, it depends what you mean by stealing, doesn't it?
Ooh.
Because a lot of it is available. It's just that it's available under a rather complicated set of usage rights, which you and I might naturally respect, but which the AI learning algorithm doesn't necessarily know about or care about.
Okay. So, Michael, when people hear that AI was trained on a song or a book, what does that actually mean? What is the process?
So it actually essentially goes through. So let's talk about a large language model like ChatGPT or something like that. It essentially goes through this thing, let's say a novel, looks at all of the words and how they're associated together and assigns weighting so that when you ask it to write something in the style of Harry Potter, it sounds like it is Harry Potter because it has read Harry Potter, has understood the way that J.K. Rowling puts her words together and can make something that sort of sounds similar to Harry Potter. And that extends to you asking it novel questions as well. And of course, the question then becomes, is that stealing? Is that stealing or is that not stealing? Because if I were to ask you to write a book in the style of Harry Potter as a human being, well, if you read Harry Potter and you're inspired by it and you write something that doesn't necessarily use those characters or steal that story, that's okay, right? And that's why copyright law is particularly complicated and why this is sometimes difficult to understand in terms of stealing versus just fair use.
If a court decides that this is unlawful, this is in breach of copyright law, once a creative work is in that data set, can it even be removed? You know, what would it take to not have an AI model using it anymore? Does the whole thing need to be scrapped? The billions of dollars that have been spent training these models, do they have to start again? How would this even technically work?
Look, I think part of the problem is that we're not actually talking about a database of all of the world's literary or musical works. It's not in the system. It was just used to train the system originally. And so it would be actually very difficult to get it removed because it's not there in the first place.
Okay. So we really have to stop this happening before the models are trained. We've got to intercept it at the very beginning is what I'm hearing. Vanessa, tell me about Kate Blanchett's Human Consent Registry. How would this work?
Oh, yeah. So this is very cool. And I went and played with it last night.
Oh, nice.
Pointed me to it. I hadn't heard about it. But so the idea is to make consent about the use of the person's image or voice explicit. So there's no enforcement possibility, at least at this stage. But there is an opportunity to lay out specifically exactly what you do or do not consent for the AI models to do. And it's specifically oriented around people like Kate Blanchett, for whom their voice or their face or their image is essentially their IP that they care about. But I think it's relevant to anybody. You don't have to be famous to care whether a compromising video or a misquotation or something is attributed to you. So the idea is it's a formal language directed at the AI to say to the AI that this is how they should be restricted in using stuff about you.
Okay, but it feels like something that would very much depend on the AI companies paying attention to that and abiding by it. And there's a lot of good faith that would need to be involved here.
Oh, completely. So there's no enforcement possibility at all, right? It's a specific request is probably the best way of thinking about it. You're telling them what you want, and at the moment there's no legal option for that to be enforced. But I still actually really like the idea because at least it gives up on the pretense that what they're doing is somehow consensual or for the good of us all or something. If they're specifically doing something they've been specifically asked not to do, then it makes the pretense a little bit harder.
You are listening to Download the Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you. And if your phone seems impossible to put down, that's because it's intentional. Professor Michael Cowling, what are the biggest design tricks social media platforms are using to keep us scrolling right now?
It's really interesting. They've been working on this for almost 20 years now. And as part of working on it, they've worked out that they want to keep people engaged. And so they've come up with various different tricks to keep people engaged. Things like sending you a notification when you haven't been on a social media platform for a while, auto-playing content when you first open the social media app so that you can see that content and get engaged straight away, an opportunity to like things and to count how many likes you get and get excited about the fact that everybody's liked things. And then my favourite, the big bad, is the infinite scroll. When you get to the bottom of the page, there's just more content that appears. Even if these days that content is less and less stuff from your friends and more from companies you follow or advertisers that want to put something in front of you. And you can just scroll forever if you want to.
I've witnessed my husband reach the end of Instagram. He's managed to curate his feed in such a way that he can scroll to the end. I've never seen anyone else be able to do it before. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
don't say that, Ray. Meta will be listening and they'll fix that for us straight away.
Now, I've been slowly trying to retrain myself, but I was very much attached to my phone to the point where if it was in the other room, I felt like something was missing from me, that I would miss out on something. I needed to be near it. I've implemented quite a few strategies to get me away from my phone, including a physical NFC brick that bricks all the apps on my phone, and I have to walk over to my fridge to unbrick my phone. I've left the house and gone to work at the office and left the brick at home, and my phone has been pretty much bricked all day. All I can do is take calls and texts, and I'm now okay with that. I would have panicked about that 6 months ago, but I'm now okay with that. Professor Vanessa Teague, what can we do about it as users? Do we need to go so far as to brick our phones? Are there other strategies we can put into place here?
Uninstall the addictive trash.
You make it sound so simple. What if it's places?
Yeah, it is.
What if it's places
you click
that people
on the app and you press uninstall? It's really simple. Do it.
But there's people that feel that they need these platforms in order to stay connected to their communities and to their loved ones, or they even need to be on there for work. So it's not that simple for everyone. Is it really the only way to go?
I do understand that if you need to be there for work, that may be difficult.
Yeah,
but connect with your friends in a different way. I connect with my friends over Signal, which is end-to-end encrypted and doesn't push extra trash at me. I used to have a lot of followers on Twitter, but when Musk bought it, I boycotted. It was hard, but I've been clean for years now, and I love it. You don't need it. Just because you think you need it doesn't mean you actually do need it. Connect with your real friends in a different way.
Vanessa, how much responsibility do you think sits with us as individual users? You know, just delete the platforms versus the designers of the platforms themselves who are creating these products in ways that have been proven in court to be intentionally addictive.
Well, I think the analogy with other kinds of addictive substances is very clear, right? How much is it your responsibility to stop smoking, and how much is it the cigarette manufacturer's responsibility not to add extra addictive chemicals into the thing? The answer is both, but they're not going to stop. The platforms are not going to stop doing the thing that makes a lot of cash for them. So it's either a regulatory response in which we start fining them serious bucks for misleading practices, or it's you deciding to uninstall their trash.
Michael, do you have any guidance for those listening who aren't willing to uninstall their apps but definitely want to be a little bit better at not being on them full time?
I know. Vanessa's super strong, isn't she?
She is. I'm so proud of you, Vanessa. I don't have your strength.
Try it for a week.
I think there is an argument that we should let the government help us with this. But of course, as you noted, we can also come up with strategies to manage our own addiction as well. And so I'm like you. I will walk out of the house occasionally without my mobile phone on purpose. I have my Apple Watch. That's fine. That'll work in terms of calls and messages, but just a little bit, right?
That feels like cheating, Michael, I must say.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, I am Professor Tech, to be fair. But you know, and then, yeah, turn all the devices off and start to sort of say, where are there other mechanisms where I can use something other than this social media? And I think last but not least, Ray, give yourself a break. It is an addiction. It is difficult to shake this. But if you can make those little steps, one thing at a time, leave the phone in the living room rather than in the bedroom, you know, turn the devices off every now and again, maybe decide to press the power off button instead of keep scrolling on Facebook. Just take it one day at a time. I think that's the best advice I could give. And then wait for the government to hopefully start introducing some rules here.
Do you think that will happen?
Look, I think ultimately they have to, and we're starting to see them do it with kids, obviously. This super famous under 16 social media ban that Australia introduced, and the UK is now following our lead as of a couple of weeks ago. My only concern, of course, with that is that we don't teach them that this is a bad thing when they get to 16. But I think the basic idea is not dissimilar to what we do for gambling drinking and smoking as well, which is interesting because I think I've surely been on this show before and shouted this idea down, but I think I'm coming around.
I would love to hear from you both some tech that has brought you joy this week, Michael.
The thing that's brought me joy is my little miniature e-reader. It's made by a company called XTE Inc., X-T-E-I-N-K, and it's tiny. It's about the size of a credit card. It's called the X3, and it does nothing but let you read books. And
yes,
I'm really excited about that because sometimes I want to get away from the doom scrolling and the social media, and this just does books and that's it. I pull it out of my pocket, read a few pages on the train or while I'm waiting for the fish and chips, and it's just a really good single-use device. And it's cheap too, about $70 delivered. So there's my little plug.
Vanessa, what tech has brought you joy this week?
Okay, I'm going to have a shameless plug for tech that we've built. So I chair a small Australian not-for-profit called Democracy Developers, and we build all kinds of open source, privacy-preserving tech for supporting democracy. So if you go to our website, you can see a few prototypes that we've recently set up. One helps you figure out what electorate you live in without uploading any of the data that you're entering about where you live or what electorate you find. It's just a private interaction in your own browser. We've also got some recent work explaining how Australian preferential voting works. So you can avoid getting confused by our relatively complicated preference distribution process. And finally, we've got a system that helps you figure out exactly what happened in specific House of Representatives elections. So you can click on your own electorate or some other electorate that you read about in the newspaper, and you can see exactly how the preference count came out.
What about that specifically makes you happy?
Mostly that it's not any of the exploitative data mining nasty things that some people have almost sort of come to believe is synonymous with the web, right? It's not extracting data about you. It's not pushing ads at you. It's Australian owned and open source, and its motivation is educational to help Australians engage more with our democracy.
Professor Michael Cowling, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you and your work?
Not a problem at all. As I often say on this show these days, my favourite social media at the moment is LinkedIn, which is interesting and very professional. So LinkedIn is great for me, Michael A. Cowling there. Or if you want all of my links, www.michaelacowling.com, including some of the work that I do in outreach and engagement, which I'd love to talk to people about.
And Professor Vanessa Teague, thank you so much. Where can people find you and your work?
democracydevelopers.org.au. And also my new website at the University of New South Wales.
And now some more tech news from the week that was. In case you missed it, OpenAI is making its own AI chip in partnership with telecommunications company Broadcom. It's designed to make the inference stage cheaper. Inference is when a large language model creates the output, like answers or images. We will see if it helps OpenAI make any money, though. Microsoft's quantum computing research is facing renewed scrutiny, with scientists questioning aspects of a claimed breakthrough linked to its approach. Quantum computing uses principles of quantum physics, like particles existing in multiple states at once, to potentially solve certain complex problems faster than traditional computers. But many claims in the field remain difficult to independently verify. And Grand Theft Auto 6 is now available for pre-order in Australia after years of anticipation. Physical editions, though, will not include a disc, with players instead receiving a box containing a download code to install the game digitally. And that's all we've got time for on this episode of Download This Show. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, leave us a review and a rating, and you can send us an email. downloadthisshow@abc.net.au is the email address. I love reading through them all. I've got one here from Stephen, who has answered the question of would you pay for Instagram with, I suspect the model is to start with obscure extras, but in the end, every function update will only go to paid subscriptions. Maybe even one day new downloads will require a subscription. The Zuck wants a buck, says Stephen. If you've got a thought on that, send me an email, or you could slide into my DMs on Instagram at Ray Johnston. Ironically, I am Ray Johnston, and you've been listening to Download This Show.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.